Now, this is Box to Box with Rob Gilbert and Michael Edgley.
Oh, what a goal!
For Chemist Warehouse.
Home of real brands and real savings.
And Storage King.
The kings of storage, moving and
absolutely fantastic!
Hello and welcome to Box, the show that is everything football. You're with Rob Gilbert and Michael Edgley to run the rule over the past week in the world game. First edition news with Willem van Dender, and shortly and during the show we'll be joined by our 250-game veteran of the Victorian Premier League and former Notts County man Dean Hennessy and our former ITN journo turned pundit Derek Dyson. So much to talk about again this week off the back of Melbourne City's history-making A-League Grand Final win over Sydney that franked their premiership title. The Matildas and Olyroos Tokyo squads are in. The Socceroos know who their next opponents are in what will hopefully be the final qualifying stage ahead of the Qatar World Cup next year. And of course, the Euros are building up to an epic crescendo. And we've got it all covered here on Box to Box. We'll get started with ESPN's Joey Lynch to review the Olyroos and Matildas squads for the Olympics. Squads bristling with the rising stars of men's and women's football. Established stars, of course, in the women's case. Nobody covers it closer, so we'll be interested to see what he thinks of our chances in both groups, which are full of very highly competitive sides. The USA in the case of the Matildas, Spain and Argentina for the Olyroos. We'll look back at the recent Socceroos draw with the Asian Games, Scott McIntyre, and wrap up the hour looking at Melbourne City's success in the A-League with their CEO, Brad Rouse. In the second hour, Willem will kick off with second edition news and the latest on the Socceroos and Matildas. Then we shift our attention to the Euros and Max Rushton from the Guardian Sports Weekly podcast. Everybody's got to listen to that podcast and, of course, Talk Sport, the UK's biggest sports radio station. If you haven't heard Max's work before, there is no bigger England man. So we'll find out from Max just how confident he is about whether football is actually coming home. We'll continue the Euro discussion with Dino and Dell and wrap it up with stoppage time. Edge, we need 4 hours this week, I reckon, mate.
Every week just seems to get bigger and bigger, but so excited about the group that the Socceroos have been joining. Willem will give us all the details in a moment, but how good was Melbourne City? But I tell you what, first time since 1966, the Poms have been able to beat their arch-enemy Germany in a major tournament. They are dancing on the ceiling and all my social media feeds. I'll tell you what, they've gone completely bonkers over there in England because they beat Germany. But they've still got it ahead of them, and Ukraine might provide a bit of a challenge for them. But we'll go through all of that and more. But Willem, who are the Socceroos playing in the all-important FIFA World Cup qualifying?
The Socceroos, Michael, will be playing Japan, Saudi Arabia, China, Oman and Vietnam. And it means, of course, the Socceroos will have to wait again to play Iran. That long wait will continue, the two nations having not met since 1997. The third round will commence in September. It looked a bit of a dream draw, Michael, until Japan got pulled out. The way they did it was from the bottom pot up, so Australia was just waiting to see if they'd be playing Iran or Japan. Although you've also told me in recent weeks to be wary of a little old Vietnam.
Yeah, Vietnam, for me, they've been a much improved nation in Asian football. I've seen them play live a lot. They are very, very aggressive and fast and attacking. They're well coached and they're an emerging football power of Southeast Asia. But how about we've drawn Japan in every FIFA World Cup qualifying phase since we entered the Asian Football Confederation. Quite remarkable. They will be a big foe. That will be a huge game. We'll play them in Japan probably.
There's much of a muchness between them and South Korea, really, isn't there? I mean, but
They are. We actually don't have a good record against South Korea, but we have a better record against Japan.
We beat
against
them in
Japan.
The Asian Cup final, of course.
Yeah, I know, but in terms of other matches, we've come up against them, not so good. But interestingly enough, the FA has been in deep discussions with the government about the protocols for home qualifiers, and at this stage it looks like we won't have any home qualifiers, so they're working through a home-away-from-home scenario where we'll play a Middle Eastern competition in somewhere in Southeast Asia, and then we'll play the Asian nations in a hub in the Middle East. So that's the fallback positions, but that's the world of COVID we live in. And me as a football person, and I just, you know, considering all the dialogue around COVID at the moment, Willem, I just would have hoped that the government could have come up with a solution to get players in and out in a bubble, and so we could have home qualifiers, because it is just so important.
This is a government that once got the name of the national skipper wrong when they won the 2015
Mike Yedinak. Asian Cup.
Mike Yedinak. So I can't say I'm too surprised,
Tony
Michael.
Abbott, of course.
That is particularly disappointing, and a big headache for Graham Arnold. Arnold this week has selected his Oliroo squad for the Olympics with 8 players with Socceroos experience included. Arnold revealed 30 to 40 clubs had denied his requests for overage players. He couldn't get them released, with only Mitch Duke and Ruan Tongyuk selected over the age threshold. 13 of the 18 currently play their club football in Australia, and importantly, skipper Thomas Deng has been selected following a lengthy battle with injury in Japan. Rob, I think the unfortunate name to stand out missing is Aidan O'Neill. We were both at Amy Park watching him put in a fantastic display at the base of Melbourne Park for Melbourne City in the grand final, but I think Arnold had made his intentions pretty clear by picking McGree, Metcalf and Denny Genro in the Socceroos squad as his preferred midfielders.
Yeah, and he wants to put Daniel Arzani back on the map, as he said. Joey Lynch wrote an article on that subject. So, look, it's a tricky scenario for Australia. We've got a really tough group to play in. The expectations, I think we've discussed it before, against getting a result out of the group that we're in with Spain, Argentina and Egypt, are limited at best. So,
group of dreams.
Exactly.
Group of dreams, Rob.
So if we know Arnie how positive he is. So look, I can understand the big clubs not wanting to release their players. So, if we're going to get a result, I think we get a result with the squad that we've got either way. I just hope that they're competitive, and I think really our focus on getting some silverware is with the Matildas if they can get it together.
Tony Gustafsson has rewarded the recent performances of Mary Fowler and Kyra Cooney-Cross in selecting them in his 18-player squad for the Olympics. The teenage pair represent an eye to the future in an otherwise experienced list, with 12 players having played at the Rio Olympics in 2016. Tegan Michael was preferred to Mackenzie Arnold as the reserve keeper, while Steph Catley and Chloe Legazzo return after periods of injury. Michael, were there any surprises for you? I think outside of Fowler and Cooney-Cross, this is a squad not looking to the 2023 World Cup, but definitely on the now, and that's probably shown by the inclusions of Elise Callum-Knight and Kai Simon in particular.
Yeah, Amy Harrison's probably the unlucky one who's not in the team. But fantastic news for Mary Fowler and Kyra Cooney-Cross, who have really set their relative competitions alight this season. So that's a really terrific reward. Tegan Micah, for me, was always going to be the number two keeper, and I think she'll push for a number one spot with Lydia Williams in the next 12 months. He's rolled the dice, there's no doubt about it, because Steph Catley, Elise Callum-Knight and Kai Simon have played collectively about 5 games in the last 18 months. So he's rolled the dice on the experienced players. We know their talent. We know the significance of their leadership in the group as well. But for me, that could be the decision that brings him undone if any of those players go down.
Melbourne City capped off their dominant A-League season with their maiden championship on Sunday, defeating Sydney FC 3-1. The grand final swung on Chris Beath's dismissal of Luke Bratton after 35 minutes, with City's Scott Jamieson putting his side ahead 10 minutes later.
The captain says, "I've got this one, boys," against Hewitt Bell. Scott Jamieson sends the keeper the wrong way, and the captain for Melbourne City puts his side on top, hunting a first grand final success.
Scott Galloway's late goal sealed the win for City, who have now won all 3 domestic honours available in Australia. Not bad for a club, Rob, that many have criticised over the journey for not winning trophy. They've now got Premiership, Championship and FFA Cup. And the story in the days since has been this will be the first of how many championships for City?
You just got to hope that this is the making of that club from the early days as the heart. They've struggled for crowds. Anybody who watches the A-League knows that. I've been as critical as anybody about their investment in promotion around game day and the capacity of an organisation such as the one that owns the club to spend bigger than any club in the competition in this A-League. So, look, I think it's great to see. I know we joked last week that 15,000 capacity was about how much you could expect there either way, but I got a sense that there were a lot of people who had been around the sort of periphery of the Melbourne City for a long, long time who were there, and they were really passionate on Sunday evening. So I really hope that for the sake of the club and the A-League that this is the next step, because we've seen too many small crowds around the A-League. That's probably the only downside this year, but obviously with the overlay of COVID. So, all good for City, I think.
And Michael, your thoughts on the key moments? Firstly, the dismissal of Luke Bratton for the 2 yellow cards, and secondly, the penalty. For my part, I thought Beath had a pretty good game.
I thought Beath got it right. No doubt about that. Luke Bratton will be very disappointed with that. He's a prime mover for Sydney FC, and they were always
first
hard
ever
up.
Red card in his professional career.
Yeah, they always hard up one losing him. I know the family well. Gary Bratton, his dad, was a hard work player for a long time, so I know the family well, and they'll be smarting. They'll be smarting, and Sydney FC are smarting, but. Yeah, have we seen a changing of the guard? I'm with you, Rob. I think Melbourne City now, the narrative is starting to emerge, and so it should. We're starting to see some wonderful sort of backstories, you know, Paddy Gisnorbo, his involvement with the club, and I just sense that they're on the verge of a very, very good period.
Heading abroad, Lionel Messi's Barcelona contract has expired, although it looks highly likely the free agent will remain at the club next season. Club president Joan Laporta was elected on the promise he'd keep Messi at Camp Nou, and while admitting the situation is not ideal, he's told reporters negotiations are progressing. Messi famously attempted to leave the club for free last August before going on to score 30 goals from 35 La Liga appearances.
Over 1 billion euros in debt, Barcelona. Lionel Messi might just be hedging his bets. Let's see how that unfolds. But I'll tell you what, he's still got it. He's been the man in Copa America.
He has been, but I believe it when I see it. He played it for all it was worth last time and then ended up staying. He's done that a few times. So, you know, he's a bit like the boy who cried wolf for me. Yeah, I think he'll stay in Barcelona, Carlos, forever. So,
that's
the end of the section.
Our listeners have just thrown their apples at the radio.
Fair to say? I mean, he's going to argue.
Earphones.
I'm not sure. People sit there listening to box eating apples. For, anyway.
All right, well done, Will.
Don't you end okay. when you listen
That's
to
a strange turn of phrase, Michael.
It is. Yeah.
Okay. All right, after the break, we're going to talk to Joey Lynch, ESPN's Joey Lynch. He's all over the Matildas and the Oli Roos squads. We want to find out what his thoughts are on both teams and you know what our expectations should reasonably be. That's next on Box to Box.
Box to Box.
Can you believe it?
For Chemist Warehouse.
Home of real brands and real savings.
And Storage King.
The kings of storage, moving and more.
Box to Box on a busy show. There's no bigger story than the Olympics coming up very soon. We've got the Matildas and the Oli Roos both competing. And look, not out of contention in the men's. Certainly, we, despite recent results in the friendlies, have hopes that we'll be competitive in the women's and maybe finally get that first medal. And a man who covers both the Oli Roos and the Matildas very closely is our good mate Joey Lynch from ESPN. How are you, Joey?
I'm doing very well, guys. Thanks for having me back.
Mate, not at all. So, Joey, why don't we start with the Matildas? We've seen Tony Gustafsson set the bar very high in the first set of friendlies since he's taken over the reins from Ante Milicic. We had a series of ordinary results before that stalemate against Sweden started to set things back to rights. Our expectations, for good reason, have been very high around the Matildas. Do you get a sense that he is starting to understand his squad more and the style that they play, and that just maybe he has got a plan that that might sort of reach its peak in Tokyo?
I think he is increasingly understanding that the players that he has, and I think that simultaneously, just as importantly, they are increasingly understanding what he wants from them and the expectations that he holds for a squad. We did see, of course, the two, there's no other way to put them, very poor results in the opening two friendlies that they played against the Dutch and the Germans, but saw some improvements in the most recent two fixtures, especially the draw in the last game, showing shoring up that defensive back line and, you know, getting some players back for those games, the likes of Ellie Carpenter and Steph Catley, their first time ever actually meeting Gustafsson in person for the Sweden and Denmark friendly. So I think they have been making some progress in understanding. That's going to be helped by the fact that a large cohort of them have actually remained in camp with Gustafsson in Sweden since those friendlies, and they are continuing to work and continuing to train. So I think the understanding is there. Now, has there had to have been perhaps a rethink of expectations heading in there to Tokyo? Perhaps, given that what we've seen, but you never know with these sort of things. It's tournament football. Anything can happen in these sort of games. So perhaps a medal still can be on the cards for the side.
Yeah, but the Olympic Games, Joey, I mean, this is worth sort of me bringing up now. It's worth sort of just reflecting on it. I think it's a substandard competition because effectively you've only got three teams being selected from Europe, and they are the powerhouse. So we do have a good chance of getting through if we can win one of our group games and draw them. So if we look at it closely, the squad, you know, we have to say well done to Mary Fowler and Kyrie Cooney-Cross. Both players had similar sort of impacts in their leagues. My network tells me that Mary, from people that watch the French competition regularly, Mary had a very, very good year. She made a big impact, so they had to go in. And obviously Tegan Micah was clearly better than Mackenzie Arnold. So they're sort of the big selections from my perspective. But what about the players that haven't been playing that are returned from injury? Kaya Simon, Elise Callard-Knight and Steph Catley. Based on the fact that all the games come thick and fast at the Olympics, is that a risk selecting those players?
There is an inherent risk with it, but there also is the reward that can come with it as well, especially for somebody like Steph Catley, who on her day is a genuine world-class fullback. I think if you are serious about contending for a medal and you do have a world-class player at your disposal, you probably do have to roll the dice somewhat and take them. And somebody like Kellen Knight, I think not only does she bring extensive experience and extensive leadership, but in a tournament like this, she also brings versatility. I know it brought much frustrations to Matilda's fans when she was deployed there, but she can also play as a fullback as well as further up the pitch. So, and that's going to be important heading into the tournament. And of course, Kaya Simon hasn't had the best run of injuries with late, we'll admit that, but on her day, she can also be a difference maker. She was maybe the one that probably would have been on the bubble the most in my mind, but of course at the same time we also have to acknowledge the news today that's come out reported by the AP that the squads are actually being extended to 22 from their 18. So it's probably likely that if that's officially announced, we'll also see Mackenzie Arnold, Laura Brock, Charlotte Grant and Courtney Nevin brought in to the side to maybe bolster it. So that might affect, who knows if Tony Gustafsson had known that coming in, he would have felt more comfortable with these players. We don't know, but that's another boost for the side.
This is Box to Box. We're talking to Joey Lynch, ESPN's Joey Lynch. Joey, the Ollie Roos, Graham Arnold had a challenge selecting his over 23s for this squad, but it's really all about the under 23s. And you wrote an article that Arnie, you know, has got a specific focus on recreating the career or regenerating the career of Daniel Arzani, a list of other young rising stars. What do you expect of the Ollie Roos in a really tough group?
My expectations for the Ollie Roos are likely to be a lot lower than they are for the Matildas, primarily because of the group that they have drawn. You know, two of world football's absolute powerhouses. And then you've got in Argentina and Spain. And then you've also got Egypt, who have made no bones about bringing along Mo Salah, which will be a Herculean task for whoever Graham Arnold lines up in his back line. He could potentially be running out of back four or a back five looking at the squad that he's brought. But I think it is really going to be interesting to watch, as you talked about, Daniel Arzani, what he can bring to the squad, because for me, he still is the best prospect in Australian football just because of his inherent skill set. It's a lot easier to teach somebody to run and to get somebody fit than it is to teach them footballing instincts and football and just genuine skill like the type that Daniel Arzani has. So I'm really hoping that we talk about the Olympics not being that major a tournament, which counts doubly so for the men's game than it does the women's game. The women's game, of course, because of the Women's World Cup being a relatively new thing and underfunded thing, the Olympics was a huge stage for them, not so much for the men. But if Daniel Arzani can use this Olympic Games to not only find form, but he still needs to find a club for the next upcoming season. He's contracted to Manchester City, but he's not breaking into that Manchester City team, obviously. So he's going to need to go out and loan again. If he can find form and really impress against the likes of Spain and Argentina, he might be able to get a much better destination and play much more regular football at his club next season, which bodes incredibly well, I think, for the Socceroos, who are, let's face it, the entire purpose of the Oli Roos. We just want the Oli Roos to prep our Socceroos to perform as well as they can. So I think that's the one thing I'm really looking forward to from the Oli Roos. I think as well, the play of the four youngsters that were with the Socceroos during Asian qualifying, Denny Jonro, Harry Souttar, Connor Metcalf, Ruan Tonyuk. He's technically an overage, but he's 3 or 4 days overage. It feels churlish to categorise him as overage. To see that the growth they have, I particularly think Denis Jonro could develop into a midfielder that can boss a midfield for the Socceroos for years to come. So there's a lot of promise in that side. I'm not so much expecting results, but I'm hoping that it will serve as a platform and a springboard for better things to come for themselves and the Socceroos.
Joey, I'm interested in your thoughts on Graham Arnold's messaging around the overage players. At the start, he said he'd only pick them if absolutely necessary, that he wouldn't base the younger boy squad around the older players. Now he said, here's Mitch Duke and Ruan Tonyuk, basically just Mitch Duke. And he said that 30 to 40 clubs have said no to his attempts to get players released, so it looks very much like he wanted them. After all, is there a touch of contradiction in the messaging from Arnie there?
I think there's a layer of, he probably was making calls to literally every club, because with new FIFA regulations, he also had to get permission from the clubs of the under 23 players to come. Clubs don't have to release their under 23s for the Olympics anymore. And he did point out that there were a number of under 23s that probably would have been in his squad had they been released that weren't. I think maybe somebody like maybe an Alex Gersbach might fit into that role. That's me speculating. Arnold didn't say that, but. With that sort of thing. So there could be giving Arnold the benefit of the doubt. There could be some layer of him just crossing the I's and dotting the T's when he's making those 30 to 40 calls, because he did say in his press conference that he got three yeses to releasing overage players to come to the Olympics, but he's only brought two. So that's one thing to keep in mind, I think, when he's talking about that. And I think Arnold was very adamant yesterday in his press conference that, yeah, I know you're going to ask about this. So here were the difficulties I faced in assembling the squad. I'll tell you now, I don't want to talk about it anymore. I want to focus on what I think is a good young squad. So I think he does believe in this squad. We all saw last year when he was potentially flirting with a return to clubland. I think the Oli Roos played a genuinely huge part in his decision to stay, perhaps even bigger than the Socceroos. So I do think he cares for other 23s and believes in this squad heading into the Tokyo game.
Well, Joey, we are all very excited about the Olympics, only a few weeks away. We're hoping that we get some good results in the football, men's and women's. And, mate, we'll have you on again during the course of the tournament. I would have thought to break it down as we go through and hopefully get through to the knockout stages.
Absolutely, guys. Fingers and toes crossed.
Absolutely. Joey Lynch from ESPN. All right, after the break, we're going to talk to Scott McIntyre about the Socceroos draw for the third round of qualifying for the Qatar World Cup next year. There is a fourth round if you're the two third-best teams. Hopefully we won't have to go that far. Scott McIntyre from the Asian Game next on Box to Box.
Box to Box. For Chemist Warehouse,
home of real brands and real savings,
and Storage King,
the kings of storage, moving and more.
And this could be the most.
This is Box to Box on 9 Radio NTS News Talk Sport. It's been a bumper show this week. The Oli Roos, the Matildas. We talked Melbourne City, but the Socceroos. The third stage of World Cup qualifying has been announced. We know our group, and to talk about it, we welcome Scott McIntyre from the Asian Game. How are you, Scott?
Hello, guys. Very good. It's a rainy season here, so I'm just trying to avoid the rain. But other than that, very good.
And who would have thought it, Scott, that every time we've entered a final phase of qualification for FIFA World Cup since we entered the Asian Confederation, we cop Japan. So, Iran, we don't get to visit Tehran this time, but what do you make of Australia's group? Japan, Saudi Arabia, China, Oman and Vietnam are our opponents. What are your initial thoughts?
I mean, it would have been good to see something else, except, like you said, Japan and Australia again. Obviously, yeah, for me, you know, I've got a close interest in both camps. So, I'm not completely unhappy about the whole thing, but it would have been lovely to get Iran. Like you said, although I don't know if a trip to Tehran would have been in the worst or not, maybe we can get into how these matches may eventually be hosted. But yeah, I think the group is balanced. You'd have to say Oman and China are probably the two weakest links in the group. I've spoken extensively to you guys about the development work that's happening in Vietnam, and I think from the next edition onwards, I think they're going to be close to regular qualifiers for World Cup. So I see them perhaps as an even bigger threat than the Saudis. So it's going to be tight. I mean, Japan are not infallible. Absolutely, I think there's an argument to be made that Iran and Korea are perhaps the two strongest nations in Asia at the moment. So you're not in a group where they are with each other. So you have to say, I think on the balance of things, it's reasonable for Australia, and the chances of qualification are good. But there's obstacles along the way in terms of nations, and there's obstacles along the way. We still don't know where they're going to be hosted or how they're going to be hosted, which could really play a major factor as well.
Scott, you've been busy since we last spoke to you. You broke the news on the Asian game that Kevin Muscat has been appointed to replace Ange Postecoglou at Yokohama F. Marinos. We know that Muskie followed Ange at the victory in 2013. And I know there's a few people who said that he just sort of went on with what Postecoglou was built, was a little bit of a clone. But in my opinion, it was far from it. By the time Muskie left victory, it was a very different side to what Postecoglou had set up in his brief period there. So we know Postecoglou has built something quite beautiful at Yokohama, and we know that Kev's reputation follows him all over the world. So I'm just wondering how the Yokohama fans have reacted to your news, firstly in terms of what Kev might do with what Postecoglou's built, and also with Muscat's reputation around the world, how he might fit in Japan and in the club.
Yeah, well, and we should start by saying it hasn't been formally confirmed by the club, but it certainly is looking that is the way that they're going to go. I mean, you know, when he was in charge of the victory, they had a couple of ACL campaigns where they played against the J-League opposition. So the name is somewhat familiar, but yeah, looking and reading a little bit of the reaction from the Mariners fans, I think it's fair to say that not many of them knew who he was. And, you know, they've dug into their YouTube highlights and they've pulled out all these kind of hard man, you know, clips from his playing days. And I think there's a bit of mortification that they're maybe going to get that style of football, which, you know, I agree with you. It wasn't a certain, mirror of the way that that Ange and Muscat like to play. But there are some strands and similarities, but it's certainly not the kind of player he was translating into the kind of football. So I think the local fans are a little bit up in the air. The media are a little bit up in the air about it all. There's another couple of rounds to go here before he'll get in. He'll have to do the quarantine period and the league shuts down for the Olympics. So he'll, in a sense, it's fortunate he'll have basically a pre-season to get the team as he wants. You know, I think there'll be a few moves he can make in the transfer market as well. But he comes in with a lot of pressure because they've, the four Japanese clubs are off doing the ACL at the moment. They'd played a lot of games in advance of that tournament. And so, you know, they're out in front. But Marinos are now up to second, still with games in hand on Kawasaki. You know, win those games. I think they're really right on their coattails. So, it's a big thing. I mean, you don't want to come in and take them backwards, but sitting second when you come in with one of Asia's best teams, if not the best in front of you, there's not much to go in terms of going up either. So, the pressure's going to be on straight from day one.
This is Box to Box. We're talking to the Asian Games. Scott McIntyre, Kevin Muscat at Yokohama F. Marinos, about to be announced. Socceroos playing the Blue Samurai in the final World Cup qualifying amongst another group of top-ranked teams around the world or in the Asian group. Edge, what are your thoughts on some of those lesser teams insofar as their ability to cause a shake-up for the top two spots?
In the Asian qualifying, I agree with Scott. Vietnam, for me, is a very dangerous team. I much would have preferred your mob, Lebanon, than Vietnam in that group. So that's interesting. I want to ask Scott, though, about Arthur Pappas, because he's returning, one of Ange Postecoglou's assistants, who you know very well. He's returning to take on a difficult job at Newcastle Jets. We do hear behind the scenes that the APL clubs are going to give Newcastle some cash to really get them going, to prepare them for sale. But my question to you, Scott, is the Arthur Pappas that left Australia to go to Japan and have that experience with Ange versus the Arthur Pappas that's coming back to Australia to coach Newcastle, what can we expect and how much has he changed?
Well, I've known Arthur for a long time, right back to the days when he was coaching in India, coaching the at that time what was the essentially the Indian Olympic team in their domestic competition over there. And I think it's fair to say, you know, as we can say with Ange, as we can say with, you know, Peter Klimovsky up at Yamagata as well. You know, these guys all they're you know from the same what the Americans call this, the coaching tree, the same underlying philosophy and principles, but they're in their own ways, their own people, and within that they continue to evolve and develop as well. I saw, all the games that Arthur took charge of in the brief stint that he had here in J3 with Kagoshima, and I think for that brief spell that he did have, in terms of match tempo, they were one of the more aggressive and up-tempo teams in any of the three tiers of Japanese football. So you know basically the kind of football that he's going to play, and those underlying principles haven't changed. And that you want to play possession-based football, you want to play with tempo and rhythm, you want to look for the spacing and movement, you want to be aggressive out of possession, and he's got all those qualities, and it's fantastic for him to get a chance. I mean, it's unfortunate circumstances, with having to return to Australia for family reasons that led to this opportunity. My understanding is there were several clubs that were really very interested in securing his services right up until the last moment when he was appointed by Newcastle. It's a hell of a job. He's already made some smart decisions with the backroom staff that he's appointed. Some of the player announcements over the last couple of days, I think, have been good as well. But you guys would know better than me, although I do still follow the A-League closely. But I think it's a hell of a job. But he's a fantastic coach, a fantastic young coach. Comes with really modern, progressive footballing philosophies. And it's going to be fascinating to see how it plays out.
Hey, Scotty, thanks again for joining us, mate. We're really grateful for your time as always.
Yeah, no worries, anytime.
Okay, thanks to our good mate Scotty McIntyre. Okay, right now at Chemist Warehouse, all Synovus vitamins are half price. There's Synovus Zinc Plus 150 tablets for $8.24. Synovus Fish Oil 1500 milligrams, 200 capsules, $10.99. And Synovus St. John's Wort just $8.99. Sale excludes bulk sizes. Plus, you can save 30% off the everyday low price on INC products. There's INC Glutamine for $20.99. INC 1 kilogram plant protein, $27.99. Half price off Masashi Crisp Bars and 40% off the entire Masashi range. Remember, in addition to visiting your local store, you can click and collect to save time. Order online for delivery by Australia Post and get free shipping on orders over $50. Or call and ask for same-day home delivery. Fees and charges may apply. Chemist Warehouse, we know the great savings there every single day. Okay, thank you to our friends from Chemist Warehouse, Mario Routinet, all the crew. Stick around after the break. We are going to talk to Brad Rouse, the CEO of Melbourne City. They're the champions. They've won the grand final. They're the premiers. It's all good at Cityland. Next on Box to Box.
Box to Box.
Can you believe it?
For Chemist Warehouse.
Home of real brands and real savings.
And Storage King.
The kings of storage, moving and more.
Yes, this is Box to Box on Nine Radio, NTS News, Talk Sport broadcasting across Australia. We were all eagerly anticipating a great grand final on Sunday evening, and despite a red card, I think we still got a great spectacle. We've got a great crowd at Amy Park, and one of the teams that's dared to dream for a long time since it started out as the Melbourne Heart all those years ago was Melbourne City, and we're joined by their CEO, Brad Rouse. How are you, Brad? And, of course, congratulations.
Yeah, thanks, gents. Really appreciate it. No, I'm doing well. It's nice to be winners.
Yeah, it certainly is, mate. Premiership, championship, you can't do any better than that. And look, for a lot of us pundits out there, we've long asked the question of sporting fans in Melbourne who don't follow victory in particular. We know that, we've got United now, but you've got a real genuine family club environment, which anyone who's been to a City match knows is a special place. It's an atmosphere where families can feel comfortable. That's the one thing that I saw at the grand final on Sunday evening that I was really proud as a football fan to see. Do you think this is a turning point in the growth of City as a genuinely big club in the A-League, which really it should be?
Yeah, look, I think it's always a thing at every professional sporting club in the world seeks to find the answers to is how do you get growth? And we know that no success is a key ingredient to that. Another part is, you know, obviously how you go about do things, how you engage with your fans, what the experience is for every touch point you have with your fans. All those things come into the mix, and you know, we've been, from our inception in 2010 as Melbourne Heart to start with, we've been trying to get those things right, and have had steady growth over the years. But you know, it doesn't happen overnight in terms of there's no sort of lever you can pull to suddenly go from 6,000 to 12,000 to 18,000 fans. It's been sort of slow, steady, organic growth. But certainly having success catapults that. And my experience of 20 years of sport now is the greatest way to get to speed with that is to own a period, you know, have sustained success. And a bit like Geelong Footy Club did years ago, Richmond are kind of enjoying now in the AFL. Certainly Manchester City, that I'm closer to, when you've got that sustained success over a period of time, that's what can really catapult you up into great growth.
Brad, thanks for coming on the program. It's great to have you here. Some of our listeners might not know that you were involved at Melbourne Heart, so you're probably got a unique perspective to answer my next question, and that is about your coach, Patrick Kisnorbo, because he when you talk about sustained success like you did in your last answer, there's certain narratives around that, and Patrick is now a narrative. He's such a connected part of the Melbourne City journey. So can you reflect on his personal journey from, the gritty, European pro that came back and held the defence together in some challenging times to assistant coach, W League coach, and titles with the W League and now in the A League. So it's a unique achievement that he's made. He's the first coach to win a W League, A League championship double, which is not insignificant. So can you just reflect on his journey with the club and what he means to the club, because he is a big part of the Melbourne City narrative, isn't he?
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm really pleased you pointed Paddy's story out, because I mean, PK started as you just mentioned. He started off as a player and also was a captain for us during Melbourne Heart. And he epitomised kind of everything his club stood for at the time. He was gritty. He was tough. He, you know, almost relished the chance to be the underdog. And I remember, you know, our very first year, we'd only been around for a couple of months, and we played our very first derby, and no one thought we had a chance in hell of winning it. We won that first one. It was... you know, so I look back, and that's my fondest moment, seeing the look of the faces and the joy that some of the original stuff of players had at that time. And Paddy was a monumental, you know, he's influential, he's he wears his heart in his sleeve, he's passionate. And, you know, that resonated with all our players in the beginning with Melbourne Heart, and certainly resonated with the fans and the rest of the club. So, he really... lives and breathes and eats football, and at the end of his playing career, he was really, really desperate to get into coaching, and you know, he was happy to pay his dues. He started off as an academy coach and, found success fairly early with winning titles in the academy, and then went to W League, and we had an incredible team that had won 4 titles out of 5, and he was part of that success. And his next evolution was to get involved with the A-League team, with the first team. And he had an incredible tutelage with Eric Mombert, who I think was the perfect person to be around as Paddy was trying to go to the next level. And it was almost the perfect union, you know, with almost like the Yoda and the budding Jedi with the years of wisdom, and it was the perfect pairing to allow Paddy to get to that next level, to be ready to take on the top job.
This is Box to Box on Nine Radio, NTS News Talk Sport. We're talking to CEO of Melbourne City, Brad Rouse, off the back of their grand final and premiership victories this season.
Brad, I hope you've had a chance to have a couple of beers, but I know, knowing the dynamic world of professional sport, you're looking ahead to the future, and I want to ask you about the future in Melbourne's southeast and what it can mean for the club. We know that La Trobe University and you're out in the northern suburbs of Melbourne, your base has been much lauded as being one of the benchmark training facilities in the A-League, but you're now moving to the southeast of Melbourne, and it sort of sets up Melbourne's geographic nature of football uniquely now with you guys in the southeast and obviously United in the western, Victory probably in the inner component. But tell me, from your perspective and for our listening audience right around Australia, how significant this move is and what it's going to mean for your club.
Yeah, look, it was, decision didn't come easy because one of those things, Michael, that you've spent 10 years of time out at La Trobe University, been an incredible, wonderful partner, and it's been absolutely perfect. We've spent a lot of time in the north, but one of the things that was unique and interesting to us, that when the A-League started, Melbourne Victory obviously had that 5 years to get a foothold into the football business in Victoria, and they didn't really have a geographic territory, so they had we did some mapping in the early days, I remember, and they had the heat zones all over Melbourne in different suburbs, and so for us to come in, we pretty much did the same, and we basically competed and contested. They had obviously a big start on us and with a large membership base, but we focused on all different areas of Melbourne. Because we were based in the north, a lot of our community work, a lot of our work with young players happened in that area, and we obviously developed a strong affiliation in that area. But and that's something we don't want to switch off. What's really happened for us is that we were faced with the prospect of having to spend money where we were to look at how do we future-proof ourselves, because we've gone from one team in the inception of Melbourne Heart to 10 teams now, and obviously with W League, as you mentioned before, but plus all the academy teams. And we were really running out of space. We just didn't have enough pitch space. So the prospects were we did a major redevelopment at La Trobe. But part of that process also, we wanted to look at what was perhaps outside that area, just to make sure that we were making the best decision for the club's future. And we took a 30-year lens on it to see, what are the facilities, what's the requirements we'll need in 30 years' time. And we were also had kept one eye on the whole Team 11 bid because we thought that was a pretty compelling and strong bid that when they were vying for the third A-League licence, and because there was some key fundamentals that really interested us. There was only one other professional sporting team in that whole region. It's an incredibly large region, and it's also been one of the fastest areas in Australia, growing areas in the last 10 years. And you've got Dandenong is the biggest multicultural city in Australia. And all for those areas like, Casey and Cranbourne and, further out, there's literally just thousands upon thousands upon thousands of households. And a lot of them are new Australians, young families, and football's the number one code. So we didn't just jump into it. We did a lot of independent research and due diligence, and, it stacked up on multiple levels, obviously for future-proofing ourselves facilities and moving into a demographic where we can potentially own a geography. But notwithstanding, we have done a lot of work with our not-for-profit city in the community and football schools and things like that in other areas of Melbourne, and we'll continue to do those. But it'll be, nice to really get a foothold in that southeast of Melbourne.
Brad Rouse, it's been great having you on the show. Premiership, championship, these are exciting times for Melbourne City as a club. You've got young players heading off to the Olympics. You've got Jamie McLaren just signed on for an extended deal and says he wants to be a club legend. It's all positive, mate. Now all we need is victory to get competitive again so we can have a proper derby, mate, and maybe you can enjoy, I shouldn't say beating up on them, mate, but, it's what's been happening lately.
No, we actually need them competitive. It's actually great for everyone. Everyone wants a derby that's close. So and I think they won't take long to rebound. I think they'll be there very quickly.
Michael.
Thanks, Brad, for coming on our program. It's been great, and we wish you all the best with the move out to the southeast. And I've got a bit of an inkling that Melbourne City might just be at the top of the tree for quite a while. So good luck with all your projects, and we'll see you around.
Fantastic, Mike. Thanks, guys.
No worries. Brad Rouse, CEO of Melbourne City. Okay, stick around. A big second hour coming up on Box to Box. Max Rushton. We're going to talk about England. We're going to talk more Euros. Stick around after the break on Box to Box.
Now, this is Box to Box with Rob Gilbert and Michael Edgley.
Oh, what a goal!
For Chemist Warehouse.
Home of real brands and real savings.
And Storage King.
The kings of storage, moving and
more. Absolutely fantastic!
Welcome back to Box, a bumper second hour, second edition news with Willem van Denderen, and shortly Max Rushton from The Guardian and TalkSport. Really looking forward to having a yarn with Max. He is a very passionate England man and very excited about this Ukraine matchup over the weekend. Is football coming home? Let's ask Max when we talk to him. We'll talk more of the Euros with Dino and Dell and wrap it up with stoppage time. But Willem, you got a stack more news?
I do, Rob. Socceroos and Matildas central for the Green and Gold Army to start. Make sure you're in the stands supporting the Socceroos and Matildas as soon as possible at a major tournament by signing up to the Green and Gold Army's mailing list. It's free to do. It takes only 2 seconds and it's not possible to regret it. Sign up at ggatravel.com.au. Injury prevented Brad Smith from appearing for the Socceroos in Q8, but he's gone back to the US and is slotted straight back into the dominant Seattle Sounders side. In the Western Conference, Seattle are undefeated after 11 matches. Smith has played in all of them and has added 2 assists to his 3 early season goals in recent weeks. Staying in the US, Chloe Legazo made her second appearance for Kansas City in the National Women's Soccer League, while in Norway, Tegan Mika looks to have made the number one spot at Sandviken her own, although she'll now relinquish it for the Olympics. Back to the gents, Croatian giants Dinamo Zagreb have stumped up 1.5 million euros for Deni Juric, who will join them on a multi-year deal from Šibenik. He'll spend the first year of the deal back on loan at Šibenik, where he scored 11 goals in 32 in the Croatian top flight last season. And Adam Taggart has his first goal for Cerezo Osaka, netting their equaliser in their come-from-behind win over Kichi in the Asian Champions League. Let's head over to the Copa America now. The quarterfinals are locked in. Bolivia and Venezuela have been the unfortunate sides not to progress from the group stage. Saturday morning, Australian time, we'll see Peru play Paraguay and Brazil play Chile, while the next morning, Uruguay will play Colombia and Argentina will face Ecuador. Michael, Lionel Messi made his 148th appearance for La Albiceleste this week against Bolivia. That put him past Javier Mascherano for the most appearances for the national side. They celebrated with a 4-1 win in which Messi scored 2 goals and had an assist.
Lionel Messi has been the story of Copa America for me. He is at 34 years of age, just cruising through that competition. His class is oozing, and he's well and truly good. The big standout game for me is Uruguay and Colombia. Colombia had that very unlucky loss to Brazil, which would have, you know, potentially they could have won or draw that game, which would have meant they were close to finish second. So Uruguay has the difficult game. For me, the others should go on form. Brazil should be way too strong for Chile. Argentina will dispose of Ecuador, and it's a bit of a toss of the coin between Peru and Paraguay. Probably Paraguay just, which means that we're on a collision course for a Brazil-Argentina final, in my view. It's exciting times for people that follow South American football. Now the group's out of the way, the big stuff starts.
So this is the final trophy to complete the Messi collection, isn't he? He's never won a major men's trophy at the top level, either Copa America or World Cup or something of that stature. So this is the one that he's desperate for. So he's playing like a man possessed.
Yeah, look, he's just so much better than everybody else, and you've only got to watch some of the games to realise that he's a standout. He's still got it.
Couple of key points also from the past week. Last week when we spoke, Uruguay were in danger. They were sitting in fourth in their group, but Edinson Cavani has scored goals in their last two games and made sure that they are through. So, as mentioned, they play, they don't play Bolivia.
Who Colombia.
They play, Michael? They play Colombia. And Brazil as well. They've got to be looking pretty dangerous. They've scored 10 goals from 9 separate goal scorers. Only Neymar's netted twice. That's a pretty fair spread. They're looking quite dangerous as well.
Yeah, they're on an unbeaten run. It's pretty significant. So Neymar is in good form. They'll be way too strong. For me, it's a Brazil and Argentina final. The Uruguay, who haven't never not made the semi-finals of Copa America, they've got a slippery game against Colombia, who are not a bad team.
Staying in that part of the world, or over that half of the world, I should say, this is a brewing story, Michael, that you alerted Rob and I to a couple of weeks ago. I've been looking to get it into the show, and it could be quite the story as time goes on. The MLS and Mexico's Liga MX have agreed to play a cross-border all-star game in August, the latest move in a growing partnership that could see the leagues merge in the future. A merge is seen as mutually beneficial by Don Garber and Mikel Arriola, the commissioner and president of the respective leagues, with the US hoping to penetrate the Latino market and the Mexican clubs hoping to professionalise their operations further. Now, the US has a Latino market, as we know, a huge Latino market, with a latent appetite for the local game. A few stats to prove that point. US broadcaster Univision last season showed 130 Liga MX, so Mexican matches, on its Spanish-speaking networks. They averaged 470,000 viewers per match. That's over half what the MLS averaged for their regular season matches in their own country. And we'll look at the recent Cup Finals as well, Michael. In the US, the Mexican Cup Final drew 3.7 million viewers, while the MLS Cup, the local competition, drew just the 1 million. So you can see why the MLS would be keen to engage with the Mexican League.
Yeah, the Mexican clubs have much deeper histories, and obviously the migrant communities from that part of the world that are in the United States are all have loyalty to their Mexican club grand. Some of these clubs, you know, Monterrey, for example, Mexico City, they're 100 years old, you know, so they have really strong, deep connections into their communities, and they've got big supporter bases in the US. So it makes a lot of sense. And the MLS is an extension to that, Willem. They're going to launch a development league to slot in between the MLS and what they call the academies, effectively almost taking on the US college system for that key development pathway. And they're launching that in 2022 with 20 teams. So it's expected that that the MLS clubs will make up the majority of those teams, and that'll be another plank in the development pathway that's going to assist the American game develop, because America at international level, in the men's game at least, has not been performing very well.
We've got so much international football going on, guys, but it's not long until the Premier League will be back upon us. It's been musical chairs in the managerial ranks. Rafa Benitez, he's about to become just the second man after Edward William Barclay to have managed at both Liverpool and Everton. Elsewhere, Tottenham have signed former Wolves boss Nuno Espirito Santo on a 2-year deal. His first big task is, of course, going to be convincing Harry Kane to stay. And Crystal Palace appear on the verge of announcing Patrick Vieira as their manager on a 3-year deal. Rob, what do you make of it all?
Well, Barclay, of course, was the very first coach of Everton when they were the only side in Liverpool when they broke away and moved to Goodison Park. But look, the Benitez decision is, it's a controversial one at Everton, obviously, because of the remarks he made when he was with Liverpool for 6 years, obviously won famously that 2005 Champions League title and referred to Everton as a little club. Long memories, Merseyside. But he loves living at the Wirral. His family are well and truly established in the area. I think the sensible people who follow the Toffees will put that to one side. I mean, the idiots putting up banners out the front of the wrong person's house. As it turns out, they thought they were putting a banner saying he wasn't welcome or some kind of death threat, put it out the front of the wrong person's house. So I think Benitez is a good pick for Everton. And look at Nuno Espirito Santo. I was surprised that Wolves got rid of him. I mean, he got him promoted. They finished seventh in their first two seasons in the Premier League in the top flight, and then had that difficult season with a stack of injuries as well. So I think he'll be good for Spurs. And Patrick Vieira, well, you know, somebody had to replace Roy to just keep them in the top flight and competitive.
And I've got a quick Euro story to finish, Rob, before we get onto our chat with Max Rushton. The Euros exit, that is, of course, France's Euros exit, has sparked angst amongst the ranks. Adrian Rabiot's mother, Veronique, has clashed with the Pogba and Mbappe families in the stands at Bucharest, of course, as they were bundled out on penalties to Switzerland. Ms. Rabiot fumed at the Pogbas after Paul gave the ball away for a Swiss goal and later asked the Mbappes how Kylian could be so arrogant. Pelé has meanwhile told Mbappe to keep his head up following his penalty miss, tweeting that tomorrow is a new journey. we've all seen the ugly parent at local sports, but surely at the Euros, that's a whole different different matter altogether.
Well, Rabiot had a hard enough time getting back in the squad after his own behaviour, where he refused to stay with the squad in the last World Cup and play stay with the train-on group. And his mother is his manager as well. So, yeah, I was listening to Max Rushton's podcast, and Barry Glendening, his co-host, was saying he could just imagine N'Golo Kante's parents sitting there with a rug over their knees, drinking a cup of tea from a flask, just being polite, like trying to sort everything out. But ridiculous. Right, I mentioned Max Rushton. We've been looking forward to talking to Max for a long time now. We all enjoy his work on his podcast and on TalkSport. He's a passionate England man, and he's going to join us after the break on Box to Box.
Box to Box.
Can you believe it?
For Chemist Warehouse,
home of real brands and real savings.
And Storage King,
the kings of storage, moving and more.
And this could be the most crucial goal.
Yes, this is Box to Box on Nine Radio, NTS News, Talk Sport. We've been loving the Euros since they started. It just continues to get better. But from an English point of view, there was no better game than the win over Germany. It took over 50 years to get it done, but they got it done at Wembley the other day. And our next guest, Max Rushton, is as big a fan. But before we introduce Max, I just want you to have a little bit of a listen to Max's reaction at the end of the game. Max, mate, I was listening to your podcast, of course, the Guardian Sports Weekly, mate, with the great Barry Glendening and the rest of the team. If our listeners haven't listened, mate, they've got to. It is the best sports podcast going around. How are you, Max?
Yeah, I'm good. You say it's taken 50 years to beat Germany. It felt like 50 years that Thomas Müller was running through on goal. And I've said this before, but honestly, the atmosphere at Wembley on, I don't know what day it is now, but whatever day it was, I think it's the best atmosphere I've ever seen for an England game. I've been to quite a lot of England games before I even worked in this industry or did anything professionally around football. And I haven't always loved it, you know, and there's obviously lots of stories of you know, England fans not always being great. But it was an amazing atmosphere there. And the noise was incredible for the whole game. And I only really noticed how good it was when Müller went through and there was, you know, 42,000 people collectively silenced by this absolute panic and this intake of breath. And like, you sort of inhaled, you were like, you gasped, and then you realized that Müller was still running and you were like, I can't inhale again because I've already inhaled and I can't exhale until this ball has either gone in or gone wide and I don't know what to do. Yeah. And when he put it wide, you thought, okay, this could be our day. And England's tournament record is pretty bad. You know, like for a team, we talk about it so much, but Southgate, I think, has won 3 knockout games in his tenure as England manager. More than the previous 10 tournaments or something. Like we're ostensibly really not very good at football, and yet we find ourselves. We've been dogged and we've been determined and we've been tactically astute, and now we play Ukraine and it's far enough away for me to not be worrying about it. But you know, you can't relax as an England fan. You know, you just sort of think, well, we should win this game, but I'm sort of, part of me is confident, and part of me thinks we should definitely win, and part of me is just in fear, like permanent fear. That's what being England fan is.
Max, let's talk about those last 20 minutes, because the game, you were there, it appeared to be drifting a little, and of course Gareth shuffled his deck a little bit and Grealish came on. What do you put it down to, that last 20 minutes where England seemed to lift their game and managed to grab those 2 goals?
It's a really good question, because so much has been written about it. And what's so interesting is, you know, we work out our sort of narrative after the result. And that game could have gone either way. And I don't think it was a brilliant game of football. For parts of it, it was very cagey. Neither side was playing particularly well, I didn't think. But I do think that, and Bayani Rone was just from The Guardian was sort of talking about this now, that England spotted a problem. If you look at how Germany concede their goals, it is down the right-hand side a lot of the time. And I think Saka had an excellent game. I really do. And I thought Sterling was great. But when Grealish came on, it moved Sterling to the other side. Grealish sort of somehow managed to free up Harry Kane. Harry Kane looked, he sort of moved better. And had so much more impact on the game in that 20 minutes when Grealish was there on the pitch, that I think that made a difference. But look, you can't discount what happened in the first 70 minutes as to, you know, how tired players were getting, and it was cagey. And I think what's really interesting actually is that England fans were patient, and that's so rare. Like, it's so rare. They were starting to get a bit edgy. You know, there was one point where, you know, England kept the ball and were going down the right-hand side, and then they went backwards and passed the ball backwards, and there is this clamour all the time to just kick the ball forwards, like, every time you get it. And sometimes you just need to keep the ball. You know, it's a, when you play that key pass, that's when you risk losing possession. And Germany proved that you really could. They could, if they won possession quickly, they could get in behind quite quickly. You know, they countered quite quickly. You know, Werner had that chance in the first half. So I think tactically Gareth Southgate got it right. That's not to say it was a masterclass, because the game could have gone either way. But I think Grealish did make a difference when he came on. And that doesn't mean he should definitely start in the next game. I think he's been managed really well. He's a phenomenal talent. England have phenomenal talent up, you know, in the attacking area, especially in the wide areas. And I think something that has been brilliant from Southgate is to not to listen to people like me and, you know, ex-pros and pundits who just, you'll hear this phrase so much. I don't know if you've used it. You know, sort of set them free. You know, play all the attacking players and set them free. You know, you don't win tournaments that way. And that doesn't mean England will win this tournament, but I think tactically he's got it right. And I think, you know, you have to play some defence. You need to play some defenders in football, right? You know, we all know that, even if we get more excited by the attacking players.
Yeah, with Gareth, you know, he's in that position where, you know, effectively, any game that he loses, it could be his last game as the England manager, certainly before the semi-finals. You'd probably say that would keep him the job. But it seems to me that, not just tactically, but he just seems to be a great man manager, and he's been getting some performances out of players like Raheem Sterling, who not necessarily had a great Premier League season. Luke Shaw looked like Lionel Messi in the last 20 minutes, marauding through midfield and was influential in the two goals. As an England fan, do you kind of warm to that with Gareth? And just he does seem to have good judgment.
Do you know what I think is really interesting about Southgate is there is absolutely no doubt that he has done everything right off the pitch. He's like a statesman. You know, he's a better statesman than the current leader of the country. He has spoken so well about, you know, that small section of England fans that booed taking the knee. He's spoken up against that. He's spoken up brilliantly about the diversity of the squad, about for every single aspect of what an England manager should do in support of his players and of and in trying to explain to England fans, you know, what it means to those players. And I think he has done every part of that brilliantly. I think the question marks, they do still exist, and you know, less so as this tournament progresses, about how good a football manager he is and how good he is in those pivotal moments. You know, in that semi-final against Croatia, did we make the right changes? And tournament football is, you know, it's so hard. As you say, it's sort of arbitrary. You lose one game, whether through luck or judgment or what, and you might lose your job. I think his job is safe now, actually, regardless of what happens against Ukraine. It would be a disaster to go out, but I think it's safe. But what we have seen is a bravery from Southgate, and not a bravery in the sense of playing sort of brave attacking football, a bravery in actually playing quite cagey defensive football. Because had England not got through the group, and that could have happened, or had England gone out to Germany playing this kind of defensive football, he would get slaughtered. If, for example, Ukraine played wing back, so they did certainly for part of the last game, if we go with three at the back again, we are a technically superior team to Ukraine. Honestly, people on social media will be furious about us not going forward at the back and playing more attackers on Saturday night. If we go out playing defensive football, he'll get hammered, whether that's the quarterfinal, the semi-final, or losing the final. So I think it's really brave to play this kind of football, because if we go down in flames and we lose 4-3 and all these attackers are sprawled out everywhere, you know, the narrative will be, look, he gave everyone a go. But what he's looked at, and he's looked at from, you know, years ago, is how do you win a tournament? This is what I want. My aim is to win a tournament. How do I do it? You do it by actually being quite stilted and quite boring. Even if you talk to French football experts, it sounds counterintuitive to say France aren't interesting. But when they won the World Cup, they won it with Giroud instead of Ousmane Dembélé playing up front. You know, they played a less interesting centre forward. I mean, I love Giroud. I think he's, you know, he's a great player. But they were sort of tactically defensive. even with these amazing players around. And so I think that shows an incredible bravery to not listen to the noise, to switch everything off. And as you say, as a man manager, he talks to Adam Lallana, wrote a piece in the Times today, former Liverpool Southampton. He's a Brighton still Lallana, but you know, he was in a few of Southgate's squads, and he spoke about how Southgate speaks to them like adults, and he's on their level, right? And I think that's really hard for football managers. You know, they're normally old and they're talking to 22-year-olds, and I think you see that with managers who get older and older, Mourinho, for example, but suddenly you just can't quite connect with these people. And Southgate really connects with that squad. There's no doubt about it. He, from everything you read and everything you learn from the players, he makes it a collective unit. I think there was one tournament where he didn't get any game time, and he remembers that as a player. And so he's really conscious of those players who aren't getting in the starting 11, even the ones that aren't getting in the 23 that you can name on the day. And I think all those things, like, are essential if you want to win the tournament. It doesn't mean we will. I mean, none of this does, but I think he's done everything right so far, and he's done everything. Look, Southgate out was trending on the morning of the Croatia game because Kieran Trippier was playing left back, and it worked perfectly. You know, he's not listening to the nonsense, and I think that is a key part of probably being a human now, is to not listen to what happens on social media. But for him to do it how he wants to do it, and if we do go out, it will be on his terms, not, oh, I was forced to play Grealish and Foden and Mount because everybody said I had to.
Yeah, excellent analysis, Max. This is Box to Box. We're talking to Max Rushton from the Guardians Football Weekly podcast, of course, and Talk Sport, one of our favourite pundits in world football. Max, always interesting to listen to you on the radio and your podcast, let alone on our very own one. Edge, jump in.
Max, you're talking to an Australian football audience who's really connected and interested in the fan culture. You mentioned about the English fans and the atmosphere in the stadium. Australian football fans with our international team, the Socceroos, have been on the end of some pretty average behaviour in places in the Middle East like Saudi Arabia or in South America, Uruguay, when we've had big FIFA World Cup qualification matches. I just noted the response to the German national anthem by the English fans, and I know our audience will be interested in your perspective on that, the culture of that, and what were you thinking when that was happening in the stadium?
Look, I think it's really tedious. It's embarrassing, and it was deafening, like that, the booing of the national anthem. I think it's not just an English football fan phenomenon. There are lots of sets of fans that boo the anthem. I'm not exactly sure, you know, the rivalry between, and I don't, it's, England fans don't just do it to Germany, you know, there are, and every time we play Germany, and it was less this time than previous times, people get whipped up into some sort of frenzy about singing about, you know, talking about the war and, you know, all these very tedious things that were an incredibly long time ago, and, you know, fans singing about German bombers and things. And there was less of that during the game. I think the booing of the anthem is really, I find it very disrespectful. I'm 42 now. I think a lot of the people in the ground are, you know, have had drunk quite a lot to drink and are in their 20s and probably aren't really thinking about it in those terms and are just going along with whatever person is, you know, whoever's next to them is doing that, and they think, oh, I might as well do that. What I think was slightly reassuring, and not totally reassuring, is when the England players took the knee, and this has been a big debate during this tournament, and in the first two warm-up games, obviously these players have been taking the knee during lockdowns. There's no fans. And when they took the knee in the warm-up games that were in Middlesbrough, and the first game it was really booed, it was so depressing. And it happened again, and it happened at Wembley, but the ovation that sort of overcame that was deafening as well. And that gives me some sense of optimism on that sense. And I think I have much bigger problem with booing taking the knee than I do booing the anthem. I don't think booing the anthem is a very clever thing to do. I think it's really disrespectful. But I think some people would argue it's part of football tribalism that just exists, you know, and it doesn't happen at rugby matches for some reason, but it does happen at football matches. I don't advocate it at all. I think it's, you know, I'd love it to be respectful and silent, and I love that other countries can manage that. But I think that is of less importance than the people who are booed taking the knee, and it was a distinctly, you know, there was enough people booing, taking the knee, you could hear it, but the ovation that happened straight away saying, "You don't represent us," was much louder. And that gives me some hope in a sort of pretty depressing state of affairs, I would say.
Yeah, no, great answer, Max, because, you know, we're all on the same page with you. And I just think the ultimate irony of all this with the booing of the taking the knee is that the star goal scorer so far has been Raheem Sterling, which is just great. Well, they've got to cheer him. So whether they like
it or not. Well, absolutely right. And I think what's really interesting is that the whole debate about that is, oh, you know, the argument argument that people put forward is, you know, we want to take politics out of sport. And then, well, then if you're booing an anthem, I mean, that's, you know, an anthem is a political thing. You can't say it isn't. If you start singing about the war, well, that's political. So the hypocrisy within that is so obvious. It's not always easy to communicate that to those people that are still booing.
Well, Max, let's finish on a high. It's not very often, okay, as you well know, that you're going to hear Australians wish you all the best in a sporting event, but we do.
No, I don't.
Mate, we love it. I was born in 1966, and I've watched all the black and white footage of Sir Alf Ramsey's heroes and seen all of the pain that you've been through, mate. So I hope for your sake that you get the result on the weekend. We'll be getting up nice and early, 5 a.m. Sunday morning our time, as you know, and it will hopefully be good news for England and for you and everyone else over there, Max.
Speak to yourself,
yeah,
Rob.
Yeah, fingers crossed.
Did you hear that?
You know what's interesting?
Yeah.
So I was just going to say, what's interesting is I absolutely support the Socceroos, right? I really want the Australian soccer team to do well. You know, I've watched that penalty shootout, you know, Aloisi scoring that penalty so many times, and just that moment. Absolutely beautiful. Mm. And isn't it strange that I would, you know, I absolutely want the Socceroos to do well, unless they're playing England.
Exactly.
But, you know, when Rishabh Pant was scoring those runs against the Aussies, I couldn't have been happier, you know. It's a bit strange how he didn't score.
Okay, you're staying your welcome now.
Fantastic, Max.
Beautiful, mate. Hey, thanks. Max, we'd love to have you back again. It's been a lot of fun.
Yeah, anytime.
Yeah, brilliant. We wanted to have you on for a long time, mate. So thank you. Good luck. And mate, yeah, we'll talk to you again soon.
Cheers.
Max Rushton. All right, stick around. More Europe after the break on Box to Box.
Box to Box.
Can you believe it?
The Chemist Warehouse.
Home of real brands and real savings.
And Storage King.
The kings of storage, moving and more.
And yes, this is Box to Box. What a great chat that was with Max. Sure, you know, some passionate fans around the world, but there's no bigger fan of England as an English journalist as well. Really looking forward to this weekend's matches, but we've got more to talk about. We want to reflect on those round of 16 matches, make some selections for these quarterfinals that are coming up in our next couple of segments. But before we do, is your home running out of space? Well, you know I'm going to say call Storage King, don't you? If you're decluttering, you're moving, you're renovating, downsizing, creating a home office. Not everybody's created the home office yet. Some people are in the kid's bedroom or the spare bedroom and it looks like an absolute dog's breakfast. Well, you can create a nice home office and you don't have to get rid of everything. You can just go to your local Storage King. They've got the answer. Go to storageking.com.au. They will give you back the space you need and you can store your stuff safely, affordably. We've got a crack team of storage professionals. They'll help organise it all. That is our friends at Storage King. StorageKing.com.au. All right, gentlemen, we've spoken to Max. We want to reflect on what was an absolute cracking round of 16. Well, Derek, sort of talk us through the highlights. You know, where do you start? There were two of the best matches in the history of the tournament, but lots to be entertained by.
Yeah, I think we'll start at Wembley. I know we covered it in detail with Max and England ending that 55-year wait for a knockout tie victory. But I'm keen just to get Dino's take on it as someone that was there in 96 in Wembley Stadium and how you felt. What were your emotions like, Dean, with that game? And, you know, why did England get it done this time?
It still feels like a little bit like yesterday. If you go to the semi-final, which is obviously the one that stuck out, was, you know, it goes to, I mean, we played really well that night and realistically should have won the game during the, you know, the normal, you know, 90 minutes. And then it went to extra time and then it went to penalties. And then, as we all know, poor old Gareth ended up taking the last one and wasn't to be. So I think, you know, we talked on off air just before we started about the fact that Gareth has, you know, most probably carried that for the whole of his time, which is really sad when you think about it. But I think there's a real big opportunity now to get those demons and extinguish them once and for all.
And if he is going to continue this journey, he will need to beat Ukraine in Rome. And Edge, I suppose you're our de facto Eastern European expert at the moment. The 1-2-1 over Sweden at a pretty lifeless Hampden Park. But what do you think about this Ukrainian team? Can they give England any trouble?
I think they can give England some trouble because they're a plucky team. They haven't performed with any great flair, have they? But they've got the job done, and it was a difficult game against Sweden. I quite enjoyed the game. It was tense. It was a traditional knockout fixture at an international tournament. So, you know, we're at this stage of the tournament now where anything is possible, and a smash-and-grab routine by Ukraine, especially in Rome, is significant. And the Eastern Bloc countries, who were looking a bit shaky during the group stage, a couple of them have got through. So that's something to consider in the scope of European football.
One of your other favourite people, Kylian Mbappe, didn't cover himself in glory and what was called Magic Monday, with two fabulous games. I'll get you, Edge, to talk about the France game, and we'll cross to Rob for Spain. But obviously, Switzerland 3, France 3. What a fantastic game of football, brilliant goals, and Swiss coming out on penalties. Give us the download.
Well, the download is when you're two goals up with 9 minutes to play, you should close out the game, shouldn't you? Especially when you've got the talent that France have. No wonder the parents in the grandstand were blueing. For me, though, I made the prediction that Kylian Mbappe was going to take the tournament alight. I think he played very, very well, but he'll be remembered for missing the penalty and the forlorn look on his face afterwards. It was a fantastic comeback by Switzerland. They've got some talent. But how about some of the goals? What about Benzema's second goal, and also Pogba? What a strike to put them 3-1 in front. So for me, it's what could have been for France. But I feel a bit jaded. I feel a bit depressed, Derek, because I had Group F through this tournament, and my teams have simply evaporated.
The group of death is extinct, unfortunately, as you rightly say. Well done, the Swiss. Oh, brilliant penalties in the shootout. Arsenal's Granit Xhaka, the much maligned Granit Xhaka, man of the match in that game too. Rob, an even potentially more thrilling game was Spain 5, Croatia 3. And you were covering the Spain group, so I want to come to you on this. And Alvaro Morata, who's had all sorts of stick thrown at him, came out as the hero.
Yeah, he did, didn't he? And it was, you know, it was such an eerily similar result earlier in the morning our time when Croatia came back with two goals in the final, not the final 5 minutes. The equaliser was 2 minutes into stoppage time in regulation. So, you know, the Spanish looked like they had it all covered. But I mean, the most bizarre moment of that match was, of course, the Unai Simon back pass moment in goals, where he just misses at the ball with his foot and concedes the goal.
What was he doing, Rob?
I've got no idea. He was just standing there, and he just had a brain explosion, and the ball just sort of rolled past his foot. And you know, he's gone from a light life in a parallel universe. His life is ruined. He moves to become a hermit somewhere in South America, never to be seen again. In this lifetime, he's part of a winning squad that goes through to the quarterfinals of the Euros, and he's throwing his shirt into the crowd, and he's one of the heroes. But as you said, Derek, the Spanish managed to get themselves back under control in
Gee, they're scoring some goals, Rob.
Yeah, they are, and Morata was key to that. So, look, I said last week that they're just sort of motoring. We know that they've got the experience. The country knows how to win tournaments after winning the three big tournaments over that period of time. This is not the same quality of squad, but I just don't think we can count Spain out just yet. I think that they are a genuine contender all the way. I'm predicting an Italy-England final, but nothing would surprise me here on the way that Spain have motored into the tournament.
Dino, coming back to you on Wales, seems like a while ago now.
It does.
4-0 humbling by Denmark, everyone's favourite team. Wales would have been realistic about their chances in this tournament, but they'll be bitterly disappointed at a 4-0 scoreline, won't they?
Yeah, look, I don't want to take anything away from Denmark. I mean, obviously the situation with with, you know, the start of the tournament for them has been horrific, you know, and having to deal with that through the whole process. So I think a lot of the world has like really gone, well, if whatever country I come from, the one I want to do well is Denmark. And it felt like everybody seems to want them to do really, really well, which I can totally understand. But from a Wales point of view, 1-0 down, and there's a ball knocked into keeper Moore, gets absolutely hammered, no ball, no nothing, and they counter, and that's 2-0. And for me, that was the clincher. If there was, you know, if 1-0, if Wales could have got to half time at 1-0, they would have felt like they were in the game. But when that goal went in, that really most probably was, you know, that was the kicking they didn't really need, and they really never recovered even in the second half.
I think Wales can be proud of the account of themselves they gave. I think reaching the last 16 is a good milestone for them.
Yeah.
And I still think they can look at that and take a lot of credit from it. Wrapping up the other ones, gents, because I know that the finishing line's fast approaching. Of course, Belgium knocked out Portugal. So, yeah, the Group F, the final team that could have gone through there, didn't. And another Hazard lighting up the tournament, Torgan, 1-0 to Belgium. And look, along with Italy, the real main threat to this tournament, the Belgians, just going about their business gradually. Rob name-checked Italy there. We'll maybe talk about their prospects a little more in stoppers time, but of course they beat Austria, got it done, bit of a scare, but they got it done 1-0. And Willem, unfortunately for your Orange, you know, didn't quite work out, a 2-0 defeat, and Schick again lighting up the tournament with his razor sharp finishing. But what do you think about the Netherlands? Are you disappointed, Willem?
A little bit, Derek. The game turned on a minute of madness, didn't it? Danielle Marlon threw one-on-one with the keeper. Should have done a lot better with that. Ball goes down the other end, and Matthijs de Ligt gave away the handball. And it all turned very quickly against the Dutch. It felt, for me, throughout the tournament, like they were a side that was always building towards bigger challenges and weren't challenged in the moment. And because they hadn't had those sort of little tests along the way, all of a sudden, when it did turn against them, it was all too much. I think it seems a bit funny to say, given Marlon missed that opportunity, but I thought they were probably a team that was going to be better later in the tournament when they had to defend a little bit more with the back five and then a few of those players and their ability to go forward, such as Depay or Denzel Dumfries. But yeah, credit to the Czechs. You've got to score, when you've got a spare man, they put them to the sword and put two goals in pretty rapid time, and that's meant the end for old Frank de Boer, who's he's left in, and I quote, anticipation of the evaluation, which translates to jumped before he was pushed, I think. So that's the end of him and the Dutch, and good luck to the Czechs going forward.
Yeah, no, I agree. And that de Boer managerial campaign for his career doesn't get any better. So I'll hand back to you, Rob. We're going to do the quarterfinals in stoppage time. Lots of European news, which we didn't get to, but I'll just ask you one thing. Can you name something that you can get for free?
What, something you can get for free? The smile of a child. Is that the only thing I can think of? Tell me.
You can, but you can also get Lionel Messi for free, because he's a free agent now. So
I've already declared him the boy who cried wolf.
He's ripped into Lionel Messi in the first hour of the show, Derek, which you didn't hear. And I'll tell you what, our listeners will be choking on their Wheaties.
All right, okay, we've got to wrap it up there, boys. We need more time after the break. Okay, we can continue this conversation in stoppage time next on Box to Box.
Box to Box.
Can you believe it?
For Chemist Warehouse,
home of real brands and real savings,
and Storage King,
the kings of storage, moving, and more.
And this could be the most.
This is Box to Box. This is stoppage time. The fourth official has only given us 6.5 minutes because we were a little indulgent. We'd been looking forward to talking to Max for a long time, and we chatted a little longer with him than we anticipated. But look, let's make our predictions. And I know we do want to. We mentioned earlier in the show, we're just going to just give a little run through of the streaming services in Australia on football. So Derek, steer the ship.
Yeah, so quarterfinal one in St. Petersburg is going to be Switzerland versus Spain. And I'll go to you, Willem, to get your hot take on how that game's going to go.
I think Spain will win, Derek, provided that they give a start to Dani Olmo. Now, this is a player who I profess I hadn't seen a great deal of because I don't watch a lot of La Liga, but I thought he changed the game when he came on against Croatia. His range of passing, short passes, long passes, crossing as well, I thought he was dynamite with ball at feet, to be honest. I like the Swiss. They battled really hard against the French, and I like their big striker, Seferovic, as well. He's a sort of old-school tough guy, doesn't take any nonsense. But I think Spain, with Morata, with a little bit more confidence behind him, should be able to get this done. They did go the... I mean, both sides went the full 120 minutes, but I think Spain, this will be the end of the Swiss.
Belgium, Italy, and I think we know where your alliances lie, Rob. It's going to be the Azzurri again here.
Definitely. I was down in Lygon Street at Cafe Notturno. I'll be down there using all the COVID compliance requirements. Obviously, those who listen to this show know I'm married to an Italian girl. I've been with her for 30 years. I'm totally immersed. They can refer to me sometimes as the consigliere, even though I don't have genuine Italian blood. I'm tipping Italy to, I think it's an upset against Belgium, despite the fact that Italy have got such a storied history in international football at the level. I mean, we know this golden generation of Belgian players. You know, you look at the Hazard brothers, you look at Romelu Lukaku, you look at, well, Kevin De Bruyne. I mean, is he going to play? That's a question mark. It's doubtful that he will play, but you know, they're just an amazing side. But I just love the Italian side. I think Mancini's got them just motoring at the right level. He's got them playing entertaining football. We know they haven't scored three goals in any European tournament. They come out and score three goals in the first two tournaments. They got out of jail on the weekend against the Austrians. I think they upset Belgium and win that one in regulation time.
Hey, do you reckon this is one of the trickiest ones to call? Czech Republic against Denmark. Is the fairy tale going to continue?
Well, I think I'm going to continue on the fairy tale route here. I think Denmark have been very serviceable, and they've, since the Christian Eriksen incident in the first game, they've well and truly done a very good job. And I think that'll continue. And I think the Czech Republic have been plucky and inconsistent and dangerous at times, but I just think the momentum is with the Danes, and the Vikings will get up.
And bring us home, Dino, England versus Ukraine. I think I know which way you're going to go, but what's going to happen in Rome?
Yeah, look, I think obviously an England win, but there are a few maybe queries in regards to some yellow cards, and will then Gareth Southgate maybe bring some of the squad players in, like Sancho, who hasn't really had much to play so far, Foden, comes to mind as well. But the one thing I do think is obviously Sterling, as to be fair to him, with three goals, and I think Grealish is an absolute must. I want him to start more than anybody else. But I still think England will win. But Ukraine were very good. Zinchenko scored a cracking goal, and I don't know how you pronounce it, but is it Dovbik on the 121st minute, so that got them out of jail. So, but I think it'll be a good game.
Dean Hennessy is available for Ukrainian translation listeners, so give him a call if you need that. Edge quickly, we're at the last eight, but you're thinking about expansion to 32 teams for the next edition of this. Tell us more.
Well, the group stage was so much fun with the likes of Russia and North Macedonia that I think they should go the whole hog, expand to 32 teams. I'm just going to rattle off the next eight FIFA-ranked teams: Serbia, Norway, Romania, Northern Ireland, Republic of Ireland, Greece, Iceland and Bosnia. Imagine if some of those were in, it would be even better. And also, we get rid of the third-placed teams getting through to round 16, which I think is a bit crappy.
Back to you, Rob. That is our quarterfinal prediction.
All right, well, let's see who's right. And we haven't given Dino's roundup of our selection so far, so we'll just park that for next week and we'll recap on the state of the nation insofar as our tips are concerned. Okay, so we did promise earlier in the show, before we wrap up, that Ed would just give a little summary, because it is very confusing as to what streaming services you need to watch football in Australia. It used to be Foxtel. Now it's just about every streaming service there is has got their toe in the water.
For football fans, this is what you need to consider when you're looking to line up your providers to get football content over the next 12 to 36 months. Stan, well, the Nine Stan Network have secured the Champions League and Europa League, so you'll need to shell out about $35 a month in order to get that. Network 10 Paramount, that's the one you want, really. A-League, FFA Cup, W League, Socceroos and Matildas. That'll be your staple, no doubt about that. Optus Sport, well, how can you not have them after the coverage of the Euros? But don't forget, they've got the Women's World Cup in 2023 and also Women's Super League and, of course, the English Premier League. They're a staple as well. And in terms of Foxtel, KO, beIN Sports, you can get this content through a number of different options, but you're going to need to pay a bit of a premium. The Carabao Cup, the Championship, I know Dina will like that. Serie A, League One, Bundesliga, and of course, Ange Postecoglou in Scotland.
Well, I think a lot of people are going to be setting calendar reminders to cancel and rebook and do all those sorts of things. I know I certainly will be, because I'm not going to get stitched up by just paying like I have done, as many people have done over the years, by signing up and forgetting and not knowing how to cancel. As Dino laughs, knows exactly what I'm talking about. Dino,
no, exactly right.
Mate, enjoy the weekend.
Yeah, likewise, and well done, boys.
All right, thank you, Derek.
Thank you very much, gents.
Willem.
Thank you, gents. Enjoy the weekend.
And Michael.
Go Belgium.
And Damo from the bleachers. We keep promising you, we'll get you on next week because Italy is still going to survive.
We'll get you on next week after Belgium background. Loses.
Italia sei desta.
There we go, dear. Italia sei desta. Ladies and gentlemen, we've loved having you on again. Enjoy the weekend of football. It's going to be epic, and we will join you next week when we go from one end of the pitch to the other in the World Game.